ready are corporates for the end of LIBOR after 2021? Welcome to Global Risk Regulators podcast series about banking and financial regulation. For more about GRR, please visit www.globalriskregulator.com. The London Interbank Offered Rate, or LIBOR, have been crucial benchmarks for pricing of huge swathes of financial products from derivatives, bonds, through to corporate loans. But following rate rigging scandals that emerged after 2007-09 global financial crisis, regulators decided that LIBOR was simply not up to the job of providing trustworthy, robust, and reliable interest rate benchmarks anymore. This saw the development and promotion of alternative risk-free rates, or RFRs. In this podcast, I am delighted to welcome Subhadra Rajappa, Head of US Strategy at Société Générale, and Sarah Boyce, Associate Director, Policy and Technical at the Association of Corporate Treasurers. They are going to discuss the issues companies have been grappling with in making that transition to the new alternative interest rate benchmarks. This discussion covers areas such as the impact of COVID-19 on those transition arrangements, issues with legacy contracts, difficulties with the construction of RFRs, and whether companies will make the transition on time. So Sarah, what is the state of readiness of corporates in terms of shifting from LIBOR to alternative reference rates such as SONIA for sterling and SOFR for US dollars? And what kind of issues have they had with that transition? And how has COVID-19 impacted it?
I think when we come to state of readiness, it can be summed up with one word, which is mixed.
Okay.
I think, Justin. The largest, most sophisticated corporates, and this is certainly true in the UK and to a lesser extent in other markets, they are very much aware and have started transitioning and have started to issue under the risk-free reference rates. So yep. they're beginning to move across. But it's a very small number of corporates, to be clear, that are really in that position. And the vast majority may well now be aware that LIBOR is going to disappear, but really have not particularly engaged with the whole process. And certainly COVID has acted as a major sort of distraction for corporates through this year. Perhaps understandably enough, they have been very focused on ensuring liquidity. They've had more immediate problems, might we say, than the continuation or otherwise of LIBOR. Having said that, I think the delay has been sort of a blessing and a curse, really. So obviously, you know, it's less than ideal. But what that has meant is that it has given the banks an opportunity, really, to continue with their own LIBOR transition preparations.
Yeah.
So that as and when corporates have been able to start to re-engage in the process, and they're beginning to do so now, and certainly as we go into the new year, I would expect to see a lot more activity in this area. But what it's meant is that the banks have actually been able to, you know, almost finalise their offerings, if you like, and just get themselves in a much more prepared state. Because one of the challenges that we've had throughout the process, really, is that it's been a little bit circular in that, you know, there have been a lot of debates about, well, corporates need to say what they want. And the corporate saying, well, actually, you know, banks need to tell us what's available. So in a way, COVID has kind of broken that endless circle, if you like, and put made bank readiness much more instant. I think the other issues, just very briefly, for corporates have been more around similar challenges to the ones that the banks have had around systems readiness, infrastructure preparedness, you know, general market liquidity type of challenges.
And Subhadra, I mean, what are you seeing in terms of readiness amongst your clients?
I think I agree with Sarah. For the most part in the US, I would say that the larger corporates are a lot more ready and prepared, okay. Especially the ones that issue debt as well as hedge their debt issuance. Among the smaller corporates, you get a mix, some that are a lot more aware of what's going on. Others that, you know, especially with COVID, the expectation, broadly speaking, was that the timeline for the switch away from LIBOR would be extended. And after the FCA came out and said that they're going to stick to their current deadline, I think there was a little bit of a mad scramble, if you will, to try to get up to speed on what's going on. Yeah. Really echoing what Sarah said, I think it's mostly about having systems in place, accounting. It's also a lot of legal paperwork that needs to be adjusted, fallback language and the like. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done from the smaller corporates, and I'm not sure that they have enough bandwidth to be able to deal with the volume of work that is ahead of them.
Right. Okay. Subhadra, maybe you could go first on the next question. Just unpacking a little bit some of the things you're saying. So where are we at in terms of legacy contracts, their fallback documentation? There's been suggestions that it could be quite a lot of litigation around these sort of areas. So are there things being done around resolution, arbitration processes, the repapering of legacy contracts and dealing with value transfer issues? I mean, a lot of these things are very tricky and complicated. Where are we at with that?
I think the ARC has done a very good job of coming up with fallback language for new contracts. Okay. The industry has adopted a lot of the fallback language for reference, but broadly speaking, a lot of the other products, they've not been very quick at adopting the fallback language. But really the tricky part is the legacy contracts and what we call, what the FCA has termed tough legacy. And the UK, as you might know, has a working group on sterling risk-free rates that was established to address these tough legacy issues. And really what the market seems to be, the proposed solutions, I would say, are on the legislative side, change legislation. The tricky part there is that, the legislation is very, very jurisdiction specific. So there needs to be international consistency among the different regions. There's also issues that are specific to products. For instance, linear derivatives are easy with the ISDA protocol, but more complex derivatives or bilateral transactions that happen in derivative space, there needs to be more work done because it's possible in a bilateral trade that one counterparty adheres to the protocol and the other one doesn't. And then you start getting into more products like bonds, callable bonds, for instance, they have embedded optionality in it. It's going to be, and structured notes, for instance, again, there's a lot of work to be done because there's a lot of embedded optionality in these structured notes. So dealing with these issues are going to be quite tricky. And I would say that a lot of work needs to be done on that front.
That echoes what others have said as well. And Sarah, what are you seeing in this regard at the Association of Corporate Treasurers?
I completely agree with Subhadra. It's quite a mixed situation out there. One of the largest challenges is around international consistency and just trying to make sure that the approach that's being taken in one jurisdiction, so for example, the UK have legislation going into Parliament sort of towards the end of this year, early part of next year on tough legacy. Europe are doing something slightly different, and the US something slightly different again. Yeah. And for your average corporate, that makes life incredibly complicated. Just trying to work through exactly what sort of fallback language they need to be accepting, I guess, is going to be the challenge for them.
Maybe you could pick up, go first on this question, because I know it's something that has bothered corporates to a certain extent, and that's around the construction of the risk-free rates, in that they are backward-looking and LIBOR is more forward-looking. And apparently this is being disrupted or made difficult to create products such as export finance or working capital products. So just wondered, how is the industry resolving this issue and what kind of initiatives are afoot, and can they adequately replace the forward-looking aspects of LIBOR?
The lack of a forward-looking term rate does make some products very problematic, particularly in trade finance. And the approach has been taken certainly in the UK, and I suspect that Subhadra could give some colour on what's happening in the US, I apologise, is that there's been a use cases for forward-looking term rates were identified back in 2019, and trade finance is one of those. And as a result of that, there has been an exercise in the UK to start to produce forward-looking term rates based on SONIA.
Yeah.
And there are currently three or four, it varies by the week, it seems, potential providers of that data that are currently producing data in beta. So it's not actually yet available for use in anger,
okay.
But it's there or thereabouts. And so that's going to be something that's going to provide a solution, but it's very much for a very specific problem. And I think one of the things that I would emphasise is that risk-free rates, yes, they're backward-looking, they're compounded in arrears, they're overnight, they are very, very different characteristics to the LIBOR that everybody is very used to using.
Yeah.
For a lot of corporates, they do not necessarily need to move to SOFR or SONIA. They may find that there's an alternate reference rate that is more appropriate for their needs, but that just because traditionally they've always just deferred to LIBOR, that was almost the easy thing to do. I think going forwards, we will see a lot more market fragmentation where you'll have larger, more sophisticated corporates and those that need to hedge using the RFRs, and the smaller, if you like, more straightforward requirements may look to use some sort of central bank rate or fixed rate as an alternate.
And Subhadra, from taking your perspective as a banker and being in the US as well, what's happening there with term rates and this issue, for certain products are not suitable for RFRs and so on?
I'd like to actually pick up where Sarah left off, which is a key point, which is that there are some corporates that might start using a forward-looking term rate, but the question is, how are they going to hedge that exposure? Because a lot of the derivatives products have backward-looking rates. So this, yeah. I think, is a very key issue, because a lot of corporates that currently issue, there's no mismatch between their assets and liabilities, given the fact that they're both forward-looking and pegged to LIBOR. That, I think, is a very key issue. But within the U.S. markets, broadly speaking, there are seven different segments. The loan market, for instance, they have prepayment characteristics. So applying a backward-looking average rate is not going to work for them. In the consumer product space, for instance, mortgages, consumers need to be informed 45 days in advance before there's a change in interest rates. So they would prefer a forward-looking rate. And broadly speaking, there's work that's being done. You have the CCPs are trying to come up with a forward-looking term rate for SOFR.
Okay.
And there's also being work done to come up with a credit-sensitive forward-looking term rate. For instance, the Bank Yield Index, Ameribor, as well as AXI, an index that was proposed by Daryl Duffy, are all being worked on. But again, a lot of these products are in their very, very, I would say in their infancy, and more work needs to be done for a broader adoption by the market. And then there's the issue with bifurcation, which is, part of the market staying at SOFR and another part of the market staying with Ameribor, and that raises issues with liquidity.
No, I can well imagine. It's as Sarah's saying, there's a kind of fragmentation going on there. So as you know, the US Department of Justice stated that it does not intend to challenge the IBOR fallback supplement and protocol drafted by ISDA on the grounds of antitrust concerns. So could you maybe describe how significant this ruling is, what it means for the industry in terms of moving to RFRs, and maybe lastly, are there any other potential judicial or legal stumbling blocks out there that could trip people up?
I think this is a very important step before the ISDA protocol could be introduced in the second half of January. The importance is that now you have a statement from the Department of Justice. This will ensure perhaps that there won't be legal challenges in the adoption of ISDA protocol as it relates to antitrust rules, not just in the U.S., but also other jurisdictions. Legal entities are going to be much more comfortable adopting the protocol. And it also clears the way for the FCA perhaps to make a proclamation, if you will, that LIBOR is an underrepresentative benchmark well before the 2021 deadline. That would trigger the pre-cessation trigger and there is the fallback, and that would get the market to adopt the ISDA fallbacks especially for market participants that are sort of hesitant to adopt the ESDA protocol, that might be something that might get them, you know, to sort of nudge them closer towards adopting the ESDA protocol.
And Sarah, do you have any views on the DOJ ESDA ruling and whether there are ever potential legal regulatory stumbling blocks out there left to tackle?
Well, probably, I think, is the answer to that second question. But on the ESDA protocol, I think that it's Subhadra's absolutely right. Hopefully this will act as a real impetus to particularly the sort of the interbank market as it looks to transition away. The automatic adoption of protocol is slightly more problematic for corporates, really, and it comes back to the point that Subhadra made earlier about hedging and hedge effectiveness. We are counselling that corporates look carefully before they just automatically sign the ESDA protocol. And that is purely because what we don't want to happen, or what they don't want to happen, is for the unintended consequence of them losing economic hedge effectiveness as a result of their loans falling back to one particular reference rate. And as a result of the ESDA protocol, their swaps that in theory are hedging that loan falling back to something different. So it's really more of just a sort of one to watch for corporates in particular, where they have that hedging exposure. As far as other potential judicial stumbling blocks, as I slightly flippantly said, I suspect that there may be. I understand, and again, Subhadra may be in a better position to comment than me, but I understand that in the US, just getting the what we might refer to as the tough legacy legislation through the US legislature might be easier said than done. And I think that then sort of leads us into the general sort of timing challenge of the whole exercise.
Subhadra, do you have any views on potential legal regulatory stumbling blocks of sort of yet to be resolved?
There could be, and I think that there's a lot of products where there's a lot of lawyers that are paying close attention to the language and being careful about and deliberate about how they're approaching this issue from a corporate's perspective. But yes, I mean, there's value transfer associated with the ESDA protocol. There's value transfer associated with any of the fallbacks being triggered for any of the products that could potentially lead to litigation. It's also an issue of what happens with certain tough legacy contracts where there's no fallbacks. And how does that get dealt with? And that's really where a legal legislative solution is probably appropriate, as a catch-all, if you will. And again, that doesn't preclude, litigation. It just perhaps eases, some of the issues that might rise. But again, I don't see that as a full catch-all for legal action.
Right. Okay. Sarah, let me come back to you for now for the last question, which is, the regulators want LIBOR to disappear after the end of 2021. Are you confident that the industry is on track to achieve that? And if not, do you think the regulators will show more patience, even though the FCA's legal powers to compel panel banks to compile LIBOR come to an end by that deadline?
If we don't have a second wave, if relatively normal market conditions continue to prevail, I believe that we are in a relatively good position to, by the end of 2021, pretty much be free of LIBOR. I think there's a bigger concern around some of the products that Subhadra mentioned earlier, which are much more in the sort of consumer arena rather than the either corporate or interbank arena.
Okay.
But I think generally speaking, if I speak to corporates, certainly in the UK and actually in the US as well, they are relatively sanguine that by the middle of next year they will be there or thereabouts, or certainly they'll be in a position to go, no, this absolutely will not work. But at the moment, we are not hearing, certainly from our corporate community, that this will not happen. So cautiously optimistic, I guess, would be the answer.
Yeah, no, it sounds like they're on track. And well, Subhadra, just to wrap up, what are your thoughts on that whole area?
So I think this is a very unique situation, right? In the past, when there's a regulation that's put forth, whether it be Dodd-Frank or the Basel III regulations, there's a very, very clear timeline and a deadline, given the fact that the regulators, you know, regulate certain entities that are required to comply. In the case of benchmark reform, there are no regulatory entities in the U.S. that actually you know, are in charge of the benchmark. It's controlled by the FDA. And I would say that both the FDA as well as the Fed and other legal entities in the U.S. are very, very committed to seeing the 2021 deadline being met. So I think that there's definitely commitment on the side of the regulators to see this through. The question for me is one of preparedness. If we get into the middle of next year or late next year, and we still see very, very low volumes in SOFR derivatives and very and markets largely are not prepared for the transition, then perhaps there's a case to be made for the regulators to rethink that 2021 deadline. But as of now, I think that they're very much on, in you know, sort of in target to sort of see that 2021 deadline come to fruition.
Yeah, and I guess it'd be a bit counterproductive if the regulators were to say, well, we could be a bit flexible because everyone would just simply slow down, I guess. I'd like to thank Sarah and Subhadra for taking part in Global Risk Regulators Regulatory Podcast Series. And if you'd like to listen to more regulatory podcasts, please visit www.globalriskregulator.com. And you can also subscribe via Acast, Spotify, and Apple iTunes. And finally, I'd like to wish everyone listening to stay safe and well. Thank you.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.